Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you another episode of A Little of This, A Little of That. We're so happy that you tuned in today to 101.5 on your FM dial. We don't exist without your presence, and we love to have you around. Remember, we're here to inform you, to entertain you, and once in a while, maybe bring a smile or two to your face. In today's program, we're going into outer space to begin. And there we find a new star, maybe a new planet. Scientists may have found the youngest planet in the galaxy, AS209 is its name. It's a young star in the constellation Ophiuchus. I'm sure you're familiar with that. Ophiuchus is a constellation that scientists have now determined is host to what may be one of the youngest exoplanets ever. In other words, beyond our system. And really the best way to study planet formation is to observe the planets while they're forming. This object may have the potential to be the size of Jupiter. Think about that. More than 5,000 planets exist beyond our solar system, according to NASA. And this week, astronomers announced that they may have discovered the youngest one yet. Scientists using the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array, which has an acronym of ALMA, and it's located in Chile, have reported in the journal Astrophysical Journal Letters the first ever detection of gas in a circumplanetary disk. Collections of dust and debris have been found around young planets. The finding, according to the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, which is partners with the ALMA site, suggests the presence of a very young exoplanet. That's the term for a planet that's found outside our solar system. And while studying AS209, a young star 395 light years from Earth in the constellation, of Ophiuchus, which graces the skies in the summer, astronomers have observed a blob of emitted light in the middle of an otherwise empty gap in the gas surrounding the star. That led to the detection of the circumplanetary disk surrounding a potential Jupiter mass planet. Researchers are closely watching the planet, which is 18 billion miles from the host star. And this distance challenges currently accepted theories of planet formation. And if the host star has an estimated age of just 1.6 million years old, this exoplanet could be one of the youngest ever detected. We definitely have to keep up with this. So watch the news, watch the newspapers, watch all of the media, because this is a really important event. Well, I'll be right back in just a few moments. You enjoy the music. Have you ever wondered why the weather is so changeable here in Northern Illinois and in the larger area nearby? Well, I'm going to try to explain that in part by telling you about jet streams. Jet streams are those serpentine-like or snaking high-speed altitude winds that on the average flow from west to east and are like rapid arterial rivers. In other words, they are a river of air flowing through a larger mass of global wind. They're broad and shallow and faster in the middle than at the edges. They form at the boundary of very cold and warm air masses. There are two jet streams in the northern hemisphere, the subtropical jet and the polar jet. The exact anatomy and behavior of jet streams is complex, and we really don't need to study it that carefully to read the signs that these winds create. Because in truth, science is still young, and meteorologists continue to debate its intricacies. Does the moon have a significant impact? Maybe, but we'll leave that to the meteorologists to find out later on as they study the fundamentals of the jet stream's actions. The position of the jet stream fluctuates, moving north or south as it flows from east to west, and it snakes or turns on its journey. It may flow from south to southeast to north northwest, or it may swing a little bit back from south southwest to north northeast. But it tends toward a west to east path. So let me tell you that again. The jet stream may flow from south southeast to north northwest when it curves back a little. I didn't say it just that way before, so I wanted to go over it again. Or the jet stream can be from south southwest to north northeast, but it tends toward a west to east path overall. The position of the jet stream will always reveal something about the weather that we will experience in the northern temperate zone. We can think of the jet stream as a line that runs between two different weather zones, two global air masses, and it follows that if this line moves over us, we must be sitting under the boundary of two zones. The weather is unlikely to be settled. Spotting signs of the jet stream winds is therefore an early clue that low pressure systems and the bad weather that they bring may be on the way. In fact, it's one of the earliest such signs. The jet stream blows miles above us, and like all winds, it's invisible, but it does leave traces that we can spot in the high clouds. The jet stream creates its own brand of cirrus clouds. These are the highest clouds. Individual patches of cirrus can reveal the wind direction. And as we have seen earlier in an earlier program, when we were talking about comma cirrus, that is a cirrus cloud with a head on it and then a tail streaming behind, they can also map local changes in wind speed and direction. But when the jet stream is overhead, the cirrus picture changes dramatically, and we start to see a very long, linear, cirrus pattern develop in the sky, So if there are multiple cirrus involved of extreme length, they're often called the jet stream ropes. They are so easy to spot that when you know to look for them, but equally easy to miss. Cirrus is always so high and thin that even when it covers large parts of the sky, it never blots out the sun or casts a shadow. But if you see cirrus that forms very long lines that can be followed across the sky, often all the way from one horizon to the other, you are looking at jet stream cirrus. All sorts of patterns can be superimposed on the main linear nature of these clouds. For example, fish bones jutting out of the spine is a favorite. Sometimes there's one strong, broad backbone of cloud, sometimes several thick bands, and at other times it will be dozens of very thin lines. But whatever secondary patterns you spot, the key indicator is that the ropes run across most of the sky. And keep in mind that our unsettled weather at the surface is in response to the activity of the jet stream as it moves from west to east in a zonal pattern, or as it begins to serpentine, twist, and thereby introduce colder air poleward, equatorward, and warmer air poleward. It's that exchange of air of different types, which is extremely important to our changeable weather. More about this in the near future. But I'd like to take you now to our national parks. Our national parks are under siege, and they're under siege by climate change that's taking a destructive toll on the treasured preserves of our natural beauty. I can tell you, first of all, why national parks are in trouble. Even small changes in temperature, precipitation, and length of seasons can tip ecosystems out of their delicate balance. At America's carefully preserved national parks, extreme weather is triggering domino effects of both disruption and devastation. Thousands of ancient sequoias been killed by California's wildfires. Heavy rains have led to colossal landslides, especially in Denali National Park in Alaska. Rising sea levels have caused salinization of groundwater in Florida's Everglades, thereby threatening endangered wildlife. Many of the 423 national parks are in arid high elevation regions, and thinner atmospheres plus northern latitudes experience warming more rapidly. On the average, park temperatures are up 2.2 degrees since 1895. That's double the national rate. This crisis is unfolding while visiting America's best idea is more popular than ever, with nearly 300 million visitors last year. Dozens of parks shattered attendance records. Last month, you may have noted in the media that Yellowstone National Park gave a glimpse of the future when a massive flood forced thousands of visitors to evacuate and closed much of the park as surging waters swept away roads, and cabins, and bridges, and cost nearly $1 billion in damage. According to the park superintendent, he said, "I've heard this is a 1,000-year event." Whatever that means these days. Well, what happened at Yellowstone? It hasn't been this warm for 20,000 years. Check it out, 20,000 years. Winter at the nation's first national park is on the average 10 days shorter and less cold than it was 70 years ago. Summers are warmer and drier. This spring, a late snowfall followed by warming and 5 inches of rain combined to rapidly melt the snowpack and create a catastrophic flood. This was not a one-off. Rising temperatures are visibly transforming Yellowstone's iconic habitats. Many of the elk have decided to graze in private lands outside the park. They've brought the wolves with them. Snowpack is generally declining and has reduced the flow of streams and rivers and allowed parasites and disease to flourish in Yellowstone's famous rainbow trout and mountain whitefish. Warmer temperatures allow the mountain pine beetle to better survive winter and reproduce longer. That native pest, in turn, destroys more white bark pine, which is crucial to nutcrackers, grizzlies, and other wildlife. But where else is warming evident? Well, the most vivid example might be the Million Acre Glacier National Park in Montana, where scientists expect the namesake attractions to disappear entirely by 2100. In 1850, there were about 150 glaciers in the region, but over the past half century, the park's 26 remaining glaciers have shrunk on the average by 40%, with some losing as much as 80% of their ice. What about the other parks? Well, Southern California's Joshua Tree National Park and its iconic prickly twisted trees are seriously endangered by wildfires. A 2020 wildfire in the nearby Mojave National Preserve left behind what park management called a graveyard of Joshua Tree skeletons, with over 1 million trees killed by the blaze. The trees flourish in a cooler, less hostile climate, and scientists who are modeling this problem indicate that Joshua trees could lose up to 90% of their current Mojave Desert habitat by 2070. Several species are known to live among the Joshua trees. They are visibly declining, including the cactus mouse and the kangaroo rat. But can the parks limit warming's harm? Last year's federal infrastructure bill, which allocated almost $2 million for national parks, including for climate mitigation efforts, such as moving trails from flood zones. In Yosemite, rangers are removing thousands of dead and healthy trees to lower the risk of wildfires. Desperate times call for last-ditch desperate measures, such as when biologists in Sequoia National Park last September wrapped the base of General Sherman, the largest known living tree, which is up to 2,700 years old. And they wrapped the General Sherman in a protective foil as the wildfire approached. Every single one of the national parks is suffering. We are literally making a choice to wipe out these things that are the gems of our world, that are gifts for us to pass down. They are indeed under siege. Not a pleasant thought to contemplate. And now, I step away for a few moments, and I'll be back with another item of interest. By this time, you're probably wondering if I'm going to give you the answers to the quiz that we had in our last program. And these were questions from our vast fund of general information. Thought it might be fun to see what score you get. The first question you remember was, what is the world's population to the nearest billion? And the answer to that is 8 billion. The answer is D of the four you had. And then, how many individuals, well, all men so far, have set foot on the moon? How many have set foot on the moon? Remember, it's 12, not 5, not 7, not 19, but 12. And then who was the first president to refer to his home in Washington as the White House? Previous to that, it was called the Executive Mansion, or simply the President's House. You had a choice of James Madison, William Henry Harrison, Ulysses Grant, and Theodore Roosevelt. And the answer is D, Theodore Roosevelt. Then we had a question of about sport. Of the following, which is the oldest team sport? Is it field hockey? Is it lacrosse? Is it polo or is it soccer? What do you think that will be? Well, it's A, our first one. Field hockey. And then geography question. The Russia besieged nation of Ukraine borders 7 countries. What nation is labeled on the map, which you cannot see, but I'll tell you the names of possible countries. It's Poland, Belarus, Russia, Moldova, Romania, Hungary, Slovakia. Well, the Russian besieged nation of Ukraine borders on 7 countries. The country we're looking for is in the southwest, the immediate southwest. It's a tiny country. It is Moldova. And then, which of these famous revolutionary leaders worked for a time as a cook at what was then the Parker House Hotel in Boston? Was it Fidel Castro? Was it Ho Chi Minh? Was it Mary Harris, Mother Jones? or was it Leon Trotsky? Who worked as a chef? You might be surprised. It wasn't Fidel Castro, but it was Ho Chi Minh. And finally, which US president speaking about unauthorized immigration said, "I believe in the idea of amnesty for those who have put down their roots and who have lived here, even though some time back they may have entered illegally." Was it Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama? And the answer to that is Ronald Reagan. That's the end of our quiz for this week. We'll make up another one soon and see what you think about that. Looks like time for us to think about leaving today. I hope you've enjoyed yourself. I hope you've been informed. Probably not much amusement in today's program, but we do have a mystery guest coming up quite soon, a guest who's trying to talk about the Civil War. And in particular, they might talk about Confederate generals and politicians. Until then, you be safe, take care, be kind to each other, because you'll surprise people when you do. Remember, kindness will unite us. And now, Willie, it's time for us to go down the road, look for some more items for our next program of A Little of This, A Little of That.